This is Tripod, New Orleans at 300. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levenson. So a brig is a two-masted ship, a big ship. And brig is the word used for a prison on a ship. And the brig Creole is an 1800s ship that was meant to deliver 135 enslaved people to New Orleans. Meant being the key word here, as we'll see. The ship left Virginia on October 30th, 1841, with plans to take the same route that dozens of ships took to the port of New Orleans.
As of 1841, nothing could have been more ordinary than this journey.
Nothing could have been more ordinary, says Walter Johnson, history professor at Harvard University, because this was the height of the domestic slave trade in the United States.
The bulk of the enslaved people who form the labor force in the emerging Cotton Kingdom are taken from the Upper South as one of the largest forced migrations in human history.
Ships brought thousands of people into the New Orleans slave market, but those on board the Creole were determined to make moves and not land in the Cotton Kingdom. Britain first outlaws the international slave trade with the Slave Trade Act of 1807, so its ships take the lead in policing the high seas by searching ships of other nations. They sign bilateral treaties with Atlantic trading nations like Portugal, Sweden, France, the list goes on. But there's one country that responds to this with, oh, hell no, America.
So a British naval cruiser trying to interdict slave shipments is not allowed to stop a ship that has the American flag. What that means, in the words of the historian W.E.B. Du Bois, is that through the first half of the 19th century, Old Glory became the slave trader's flag of choice.
Other countries became hip to what the U.S. flag meant at sea and started switching flags.
Say you're a Spanish slave trader and you see a British naval ship on the horizon, the first thing the slave traders do is they run up the American flag, because that way they are protected by the mantle of American national sovereignty, of U.S. national sovereignty, from British surveillance.
So we were notoriously defiant and we knew it. But back to 1841 and the brig Creole, sailing the Atlantic under that flag and everything it represented. A week into the journey, on the night of November 7th,
one of the slave traders aboard the Creole hears noise in the hold.
William Merritt.
He sees Madison Washington, who is one of the enslaved men who's been shipped on board the Creole, out of the hold where he's supposed to be. And there's a confrontation, and as the slave trader escapes from Washington's grasp and runs back onto the deck of the ship, he hears a shot fired and realizes that some of the slaves in the ship are in revolt. Within 4 or 5 hours, the slaves have complete control of the ship.
One slave trader is killed and thrown overboard, and Captain Robert Ensor is wounded. 19 slaves are later identified as the rebels responsible for the revolt. They had heard of a ship that had departed from Virginia the year before and shipwrecked in the Bahamas. That was British territory, no slave trade allowed, and those shipwrecked slaves were eventually emancipated by the local British government. It was with that story in mind that the rebels took command of the brig Creole and rerouted it to Nassau, Bahamas, where the real drama began. You're listening to Tripod, New Orleans at 300. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levenson. The ship sails into the port in the Bahamas, and at that point, the 19 rebels kind of step down from power to mix in with the rest of the slaves. This is in hopes of not being targeted as criminals, but what it also does is allow the white crew to reassert control and let Old Glory do the talking.
By raising the American flag is to say to the British, you have no interest in this. Just give us back the cargo and we'll push on to New Orleans.
Not so fast, says the British, who come on board to investigate what happened. They're told by the brig Creole crew that a group of slaves rebelled and briefly took control, which is why they're docked in Nassau. But the Brits respond by saying, hey, USA, you can't claim that a slave revolt has occurred. Not here, anyway.
Because if there's no such thing as slavery in the British Empire, then there cannot be a slave revolt.
The white crew just wants to keep the slaves on board, get back out to sea, and go make their profit in New Orleans. But Johnson points out that the community of Nassau at that time is mainly African. It's full of emancipated slaves and the West Indian Regiment of Britain's army. They realize what's going on relates to them.
Something which relates to them, to the extent that many of them get into small boats with clubs and go out and position themselves around the Creole in order to protect it from any effort by the white crew to take it away and sail it back to New Orleans.
One of the details I loved was that when the Americans were kind of like, okay, we need to, you know, regain control, but wait, we didn't really have that many weapons to begin with. They try to buy more weapons, and no one in Nassau will sell them any weapons.
No, nobody will sell them weapons. So it's a fairly extraordinary scene that unfolds in the harbor there.
It's kind of like there's this revolutionary Black Atlantic. There's the symbol of the American flag moving through the water saying, you know, don't mess with us. Don't touch us. Don't look at what we're doing. Don't tread on me. There's the British who have said, you know, we've abandoned this ideology of slavery. And then yet it all kind of seems like it really just comes to a head at Nassau, all three of those kind of forces.
Absolutely. I mean, it's pretty amazing what they did, right? So there's a story of the establishment of political solidarity under extreme conditions here.
Political solidarity on many levels. As Johnson describes, the community in Nassau surrounds the docked brig Creole in smaller boats to say, you guys aren't going anywhere with those slaves. They're not yours anymore. The local government defends the community's actions and lends further support with their army. And the whole town boycotts American business by refusing to sell them weapons. Johnson says that it's also important to remember that before all this was the plan to take over the ship in the first place.
Right. I mean, that these are 19 people who are from different areas of Virginia who have not known one another before they met in the slave pen and then on the slave ship. And within a week, they come to trust one another enough to risk their lives on this venture. That's incredible.
This is not something the white crew was expecting. Otherwise, the ship's captain, Robert Ensor, would have never brought his family along. I quoted something Johnson wrote back to him. For what else to call the oblivious confidence with which a man like Ensor brought a 15-month-old child aboard a slave ship than an aspect of the property he held in his own slave-produced whiteness, a certainty born of history that events would break in his favor, that all would be well.
Right. And yet he's willing to lie to himself and say this is going to go all right, just like it always has before. And it doesn't. It doesn't go all right.
For the slave traders, at least. After months of depositions, insurance claims, and detention in jail, all the slaves, including the 19 rebels, were offered freedom if they stayed in Nassau. According to Johnson, ignorance and denial on behalf of the whites on board is what made something like this possible. They chose not to see that this cargo was capable not only of organization, but heroism. He says it all goes back to when the slave trader William Merritt first discovered one of his previously obedient slaves out of the hold.
That moment seems to me to be an extraordinary moment, that moment where this man, Merritt, who thought that he was in one kind of history, is forced to confront that something doesn't make sense, something's happening that he doesn't understand, and he says, but you're the last person I would expect to be out of order on this ship. And then it gradually dawns on him, and he starts to run, and that seems to me to be a moment and a sense of possibility and danger that it's really worth us trying to imagine and capture.
This boat-wide emancipation was celebrated by abolitionists and used in efforts to close the U.S. domestic slave trade. New Orleans was the main engine of that trade and continued to profit from it for another 20 years. And although the story of the brig Creole doesn't end in New Orleans, it was meant to. And that shows the city's prominent role within an Atlantic world full of slavery and revolution. Talk about rocking the boat. Tripod is a production of WWNO New Orleans Public Radio in collaboration with the Historic New Orleans Collection and the University of New Orleans Midlow Center for New Orleans Studies. Special thanks to Evan Christopher for the opening theme music. Catch Tripod on the air Thursdays at 8:30 a.m. and Monday afternoons on All Things Considered. To hear this episode of Tripod again, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or go to WWNO.org where you can find original insurance documents filed by the brig Creole. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levinson, and I'll tripod you later.